Hello, welcome to When Songs Mean Business. I'm your host, Steph Belcher, and today I am chatting with my lovely friend, Sabrina Underwood. Sabrina and I met at DIME, the Detroit Institute of Music Education, after she got the job that I really wanted, which was marketing manager for the record label Original 1265 Records. I ended up getting a teaching job, and I started there anyway. And once I got to know her, I realized how perfect she was for that record label job. And we became friends. She's one of the inspirations for this podcast because Sabrina embodies what I think is the driving engine of the music business. She is a hardworking, humble giant busting her tail behind the scenes to make sure that music moves through the pipeline from the studio to the masses. She's not famous. She's not a household name, but she's been involved with the release and promotion of some of the biggest songs in the world. She's worked in promotions, distribution, sales, and marketing, and she's currently working as an artist manager. So in this conversation, you'll hear us talking a lot about relationships, and that is one area where Sabrina really excels. She is really a role model for people who want to make things happen and just get music out into the world. So without further ado, let's dive into When Songs Mean Business. Sabrina, hello.
Hey, Stephanie. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. I'm so excited to finally be doing this. We have been talking about this podcast for years. I think it was winter of 2018.
Yes, it's been a little time.
Yeah.
But I'm really proud that you've pushed forward. And I think it is such an amazing platform for you and for the mission that you have behind it. It's definitely needed. So I'm glad to be a part of it.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. That's so nice to hear. I've wanted to interview you in this format for a long time, and I really appreciate you joining me right at the beginning.
Yes, yes, of course. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So speaking of beginnings, mm-hmm. I would like to hear your story early days. I want to know what kind of music you listened to when you were little, like when you first kind of figured out that you could play your own radio. You know, did you have a Walkman? Did you have a Discman? What was in it? What kind of situations did you listen to music? And when did you first kind of realize that you loved music deeper than other people maybe?
Okay. Oh, that's fun. So let's just start by saying when I was a little girl, my grandfather, who's from Belize, used to sit us out on the front porch sometimes while he played the clarinet when we were little bitty girls. Whoa. And coming up, hearing the beautiful sound of the clarinet, I knew I wanted to play an instrument. My mom was an avid record collector. I think to this day, still, she has over 6,000 records, 45s and LPs. Wow. And my dad, from his earliest years as a young boy, was self-taught along with my grandmother to play piano. So before I was born, I had two crazy music loving parents. And coming up, some of my earliest memories are like smoky red and blue lights. And I believe they had me in some crib somewhere behind stages while he played. He actually became a professional musician and toured the world and opened up for like the Jacksons and played with Chairman of the Board and things like that. So
your dad did?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's so cool. Played.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yep. And so I came up in music and it was just inevitable for me. I would say the earliest years I can remember, the thing that really stands out to me was Prince, I Want to Be Your Lover. That was a song that still to this day plays in my head as far as like some of the earlier songs. Now, mind you, growing up, especially with the Underwood side of my family being from Belize, I grew up coming downstairs listening to country music, Elvis Presley, Charlie Pride, the Mandrill Sisters, Dolly Parton. Old country hymns were popular in Belize, mm-hmm. besides Caribbean music. And then my grandmother and my mom and those guys would play soul music and blues music. So Ella Fitzgerald and, you know, old, you know, Black Negro spirituals, you know. Yeah. So we listened to everything, including rock in our household. So I came up listening to it all. But I used to love to watch Debbie Boone and stuff like that. Like I grew up on all this stuff, but the earliest songs that that just stick to me again was Prince, I Want to Be Your Lover. And my mom used to play that on her record player. And I fell in love with the man on Pegasus. I remember he was the back of that album cover was him sitting on a white horse with wings. She allowed me to play her coveted record player. So at 8, I would flip records. And I knew how to put the needle on without skipping it. And so I would just listen to all kinds of music. Although she did tell me the only song when I was much younger that I would dance to was Elton John, Benny and the Jets. So according to the family, that was my hit. But for me, I remember the one that really, really stood out was Prince, I Want to Be Your Lover, to answer that in a short form.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that. So did you go on to play an instrument?
I did. I ended up playing flute. I played the clarinet, but I stuck with the horn. I loved brass, and I played trumpet for 9 years.
Wow.
And when I got to Eastern Michigan University, though, I didn't want to audition. I didn't think their band was hot. I wanted to go like to Florida A&M and get into like the Southern bands down there so I could rock out. But so I kind of hung that up. Okay. But yeah, I did play horn.
When was the last time you played?
Oh, geez. First of all, my armature is gone now. But the last time I probably picked it up, and I used to love to play this one jazz tune. It had to be probably in like 91.
Oh, too long.
That was the last time that I absolutely like picked it up and played. Other than that, you know, when I'm around in studios and stuff before, you know, we of course sterilize the mouthpiece. I try to get in a few tunes, but yeah, I'm not that good anymore. I'm a rusty bucket.
I understand. Yeah. Did you ever play the piano? Did your dad would like nudge you toward what? The piano?
I played an organ.
Oh.
That had numbers when I was younger. But no, and I did promise my dad and my grandmother, who actually is 90. Grandma is 95. She's about to be 96, and she still plays for her church, and
oh
she still plays for the little ladies, and she plays the ones with the foot pedals. So grandma gets down. And I promised them both that I would learn to play piano. So quite honestly, that's my Christmas gift to myself. I'm going to get a nice keyboard and, you know, start to learn how to play this
year. Heck yeah. That's fantastic. I love that goal. I ended up with my great grandma's piano. There's a lot of similarities in our musical families, you know, going back like so far that you don't even know where it started. You just know that you're always going to do music.
Yep.
And I ended up with my Gigi's piano. It's from 1930. Ooh, yeah.
That's beautiful. Yeah, see,
it's cool. Yeah. It's fun. Sometimes I'll just, you know, just sit down and play, and it's a nice way to kill a half hour or whatever.
True. Very true.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Awesome. I love that story. So when did you know that you wanted to do the business side?
You know what? I would say it had to be around 8.
Oh, wow.
Very early. I used to listen in on a lot of conversations and things, but I was so enamored with Prince. I promise you. I was so enamored with him. And, you know, back in the day, album covers, you had the album covers that were well designed, but you had the album sleeve inside that listed all the lyrics, and it had like cool art and all kinds of things. And I used to find myself looking forward to flipping open. Sometimes they, you know, flip open, but opening up the album cover, reading all the liner notes. A lot of it, I didn't understand it at 8 and 9, but I was just so enamored with all of that kind of thing. And listening to my dad talk about the business, it intrigued me, you know, and this was before I even knew I was going to play an instrument. I just knew that I wanted to work with Prince, and that's what I was going to do. And at age 8, I knew this.
And you know, what
I mean? I spoke that thing out. So yeah. Just his music and watching and learning about those things and reading the lyrics and things like that, it just intrigued me at a young age. So I kind of knew that I wanted to be involved in the thing that made me feel so good, you know, every time I heard it, and just to watch how it would affect people when they listened. You know, I was just that intuitive as a young person. So I knew then, this is what I want to do. I didn't know much about what that was, but sure. I knew I wanted to be in it.
Sure. And how did that process go for you when you said you went to Eastern Michigan? Were you involved with the music business when you were in college or even in high school? And like, you know, did you kind of get started with it all? Yep. Besides just your parents introducing you to it, which I think is amazing. You know, it's so cool that they introduced you to it and didn't try to dissuade you. I think that's really cool.
No, not at all. And then of course, you know, around those times in the earlier years, we had an anchor here, which was Motown. And then when I came up, Motown, it flew the coop and they went to LA. And of course, we're Detroit Rock City, right? And we had, you know, house and techno and those types of things. But as it related to soul music, our anchor pretty much uprooted, you know? So we didn't have an actual business here for me to really tap into. But the blessing is, okay, so fast forward. Yes, throughout high school, I helped put, actually, I used to do my own parties, what we call cabarets.
Ooh, and,
sexy. But they were, we came with our little non-alcoholic beverages. And actually, DJ Don Q, who's on WJLB, well, he was on WJLB, but he's long time on WJLB, was Donnie Morris, a good friend of mine from high school. We were always dance partners. And Donnie would, as a young person, he'd be our DJ and we would go out and rock. And so I started doing like party promotions back in like the 11th grade. And then when I got to Eastern Michigan, I was able to help to shape my own program, which was an arts management degree, because I knew I wanted to do business, but I wanted to do it for the arts. And so Eastern had a special program where we could do that. And so I did. And I ended up getting an internship at PolyGram Music before they merged into Universal. And that's where I really got a chance to see the inner workings of the music business. Prior to that, I had an idea, but I really didn't know until I started my internship. And that just opened up doors for me.
Sure. So let's talk about that for a little while. What was your first day like?
Exciting.
Yeah.
I remember.
Was it in Detroit?
It was in Metro Detroit. It was located in Warren, Michigan.
Okay. Cool.
And surprisingly, that's where I first met Scott Guy.
Oh, I should interview him.
Yes. Scott was, and I thought it was super cool because he was like this black dude who rocked this afro with an afro pick with a fist in the back. And he was like the representative for rock music. And I was like, oh, that's so dope.
Yeah, he's the coolest.
Yeah, he's so cool. But yeah, so I started there and my first day was amazing. I can remember walking through, seeing all the posters and all the music and all the cool t-shirts and swag and things like that. And at that time, Brian McKnight was really just getting started. And I was in particular working with Mercury Records in the promotions department with them. And I got an opportunity to really sit in and listen to a lot of you know, the inner workings of what they were doing to try to get songs on radio. But I walked away my first day. I came back with hoodies and hats and all kinds of cool stickers and Chotskys and mugs with, you know, different artists' faces on. I was like, oh, this is dope. This kind of fun. But it was just cool because when you walked in to hear music blaring from every office and people really having fun doing what they love to do, I knew at that point, this is where I belong.
So what happened next in your career after, what else did you do at PolyGram?
Well, at PolyGram, the good thing about it, and this is one thing that I will instill in people, if you can get a good internship, if this is the business that you really want to be in, regardless, whether you get a mentor or you become an apprentice or on the business side, getting an internship or working up under, you know, it's very important. I got a chance to really understand the inner workings of distribution, sales, marketing, what really went into it, getting those white envelopes from the New York office with these new artists that you never heard of, where they're saying, hey, we're looking at signing this person, or we just signed this person. Give us your feedback. This is who played on it. This is who wrote with them. This is what, you know what I mean? So to be able to be a part of that in the early stages and to know that your feedback matters and can shape the trajectory of how this person is put out or even whether or not they're going to get signed
was huge
for me. And at the time we were still doing flyers and things like that, you know, like the most grassroots things, but then to see how it all flourished and how it all came together was just an amazing experience. From there, you know, I learned the importance of networking. And as a young person, I was out, you know, thankfully the guys that I worked under would call me up or grab me up and say, hey, we're going here. We're going to this nightclub, or we're going to this radio station, or we're going to this television, you know, network studio, come along. You need to see this. And through that, I got a chance to meet the gentleman. His name is Joe Stills, and he worked for Sony Music. And here in Michigan, we had PolyGram had an office, Warner Brothers had an office, SEMA, which is no longer in play, had an office, BMG had an office, and Universal had an office from what I remember here at the time. And so we did have the distribution companies here, and Sony's was based in Cleveland. So Joe would drive up from Cleveland and we met up at a retail store and just really clicked. And so thankfully he thought enough of me and had seeing me work and in action so that when a college rep position came open for Sony, he threw my name in the hat and I interviewed for it. I beat out another guy. I almost didn't get it. And I got the job.
Nice.
And so, yeah, so I started as a college rep for Sony. And with that, I got a chance to work all of the artists that Sony signed that were priorities for college. For instance, Jamiroquai, The Fugees, oh. Destiny's Child, even, you know, certain songs of Mariah Carey, Big L was one, rest his soul. There were quite a few developing artists. They would give us as college reps the developing artists to push. And so my territory was not just Michigan, it was Ohio. So I had Ohio State University and Wilberforce and things like that. So my job at the time was to get songs played on radio, pitch interviews with the media, set up on-campus promotions, try to set up performances, you know, that kind of thing. And so it was like really dope also being like one of the coolest people on campus, you know what I mean? Who had all the goods, you know, and working with DJs and going to lifestyle shops and tattoo shops and all kinds of things to get music played. However we could get the music exposed, that's what we did. And then we reported it all back up. And so my college rep years were the first time, it was the first time that I really understood how to really roll up my sleeves and be in charge of a market, you know? So it was really good. It was the one of the greatest experiences that I had. Plus I had a fresh team. And my boss, rest his soul, Ron Archer, became my big brother and my mentor. And so they really, Sony, we were the first in the country to have a Black music college marketing department.
Oh, nice.
And so I was really excited about being a part of that inaugural team as well. And so from there, I just grew up the chain. And I went to from there to retail marketing, where I focused on a lot of accounts at this time. So then we got a chance to understand the inner workings of setting up sales programs and trying to get places to bring in the product and have it up front so that people can see it and play it and talk about it when people are, you know, coming in and buying to get your artist seen and your artist pushed and your artist heard over everybody else. I didn't care about Mary J. Blige. Actually, I did, but I need you to push this Mariah Carey, put her to the side because she ain't part of what we doing over here, you know? So it was fun. And then throughout all of that, you develop these great relationships with your competitors who are to this day still my brothers and sisters. And so from there, I actually was promoted and Sony moved me to Washington, D.C., which at the time was like the number three market in the country. So I covered number three region in the country. I covered the entire Mid-Atlantic region. So from South New Jersey all the way to the tip of North Carolina, Philly, D.C., Baltimore, Richmond, Norfolk. Those were my territories.
And it's so a lot of traffic.
It was a lot of traffic, a lot of driving. And so I had to pretty much amplify and push and help to break artists and music in, you know, in that region. And it was a lot of stress. It was a lot of pressure because these were go-to breakout markets. And it was a market that other markets around the country kind of looked at to get a barometer. Plus, on top of that, a lot of our artists lived in my territory. And so if you left a stone unturned, that was your A-double-S, you know?
Yeah.
And so for me, in my territory, I had Will Smith, I had Saul Williams, you know, I had Jill Scott, I had all these people, you know, I'm in their backyards, so, or their family's backyards. So I had to really make sure to stay on top of my game. Not that I would have slagged, but it's kind of tough, you know, a lot of times when you're, you know, you're responsible for an entire region that was so super important. And so from there, I actually quit.
Oh, yeah.
After 3 years, I quit because of love. I was super in love with the guy, and I took the opportunity, and the goal was for us to come back together. And because of love, I quit my job because, of course, long distance can put a strain on a relationship.
Yeah.
And love to me at the time in my life with him was more important than growing up the corporate ladder in music. Yeah, I did say that, didn't I? So
I did the same thing. I did the same thing.
Yeah. And at the time, Epic Records and Columbia Records were tapping on my boss for me. They wanted me to become a product manager, which was one of my goals. But love, right? So yeah. I resigned and moved to BFE, Kalamazoo, Michigan. Jesus have mercy. From DC to Kalamazoo, Michigan. And ended up working as a manager at a record store, girl, to say the least. And it happened to be a store that I used to service. There's a story behind that. I quit because I had a job offer making way more money in medical sales. But when I got to Michigan, the job fell through. And because Michigan was an at-will state, there was nothing I could do. I was just stuck and I quit my job. So I was there for like a year, and a good friend of mine from BMG contacted me because the relationship didn't work out. Relationship didn't work out,
but you tried. So you tried. You had to try.
Yeah.
I always would have bothered you.
Yeah. Because we were together for like 10 years.
Oh,
so yeah, you know, you don't just throw stuff away. So anyway, I came to Detroit and worked for BMG, and then we merged with Sony. So I was back with my old team.
Woo-hoo.
And the blessing with Sony is that they gave me tenure. So it was just like I never even stopped. And they connected all of my years together.
That's fantastic.
So it gave me, at this point, 12 years with them.
That's fantastic.
And so I just kind of moved up the chain. BMG became Sony BMG. And then I transitioned to do radio promotions for Columbia. It really wasn't my cup of tea. I knew it wasn't really going to be. And a couple other opportunities came up for growth. And so I resigned and went full-time independent. But one thing that I would like to say is, sidebar, back when I was in DC, I did do something that most people would get fired for doing, but I did it anyway, because it was a great opportunity that came to me to work for Prince. So who's not going to take that? And so I got an opportunity to do contract work for Paisley Park. And during this time, my life was just on a full tilt. I was just living life like it was gold, and it was a dream come true. And it started on the eve of my 28th birthday. So that was a great birthday gift.
Yeah.
And how it all came about was amazing. So that's it in a nutshell. I ended up also working with, just picking back up. Yeah. After I left Columbia, I went independent. I started working with an amazing producer and artist. His name is Denon Porter. People also know him as Mr. Porter. And I started working with him as his right hand and now general manager and partner. And then from there, I also worked with Toya Hankins, the great Toya Hankins, who's now managing Cam Anthony, who just won The Voice. But at the time, she was the longtime manager for the artist Kim. Mm-hmm. And so I joined her project production producers team and was part of that management team. And so that was an amazing experience. And then I ended up at Original 1265 Records, where I had an opportunity to work with independent artists that were coming through the Detroit Institute of Music Education system.
And that's where we met.
Gosh. Oh, did I forget? Yes. I worked at ASCAP too as an area licensing manager. Oh my goodness. Geez, I've kind of touched it all, huh?
You really have. Yeah. There's so much juicy stuff here that I want to dive into.
Okay.
So I have to ask you about the Fugees. Talk to me about the Fugees, like, because that's one of those, you know, groups, bands with three incredibly talented people that came together and made gold and then disappeared. I mean, you know, individually they didn't disappear.
Right.
But talk to me about what it was like to promote the Fugees.
First of all, that to this day, and you know, we're celebrating, what is it now? 30 years, 25 years this year, the release of the score. I remember the day I got that album in the mail.
Tell me about that day.
It was amazing. Because I was already a Fugees fan, and I put that CD in because, you know, it was the time we were getting CDs. Mm-hmm. And I popped it in and just fell in love. I think I played it over. If I could have warped a disc, I did. And it was our jobs to listen to the music and come up with what we thought should be singles, even though, of course, the New York offices determined those. But sure. We got a chance to offer our feedback and come up with really, really dope marketing plans. At the time, I was a college rep for Sony. So I really became that girl on campus because I had Fugees.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing experience. We got a chance to really, really break some amazing music. When they came through the market on tour, just imagine having Lauren Wyckoff, Clough, and Pros in your car. Imagine driving them around to WHFR, Henry Ford Community College, WIDR, you know, freaking Western Michigan, you know, all these different places to do college radio and to do meet and greets and to do club nights. It was fun. To this day, those are some of the most memorable times. And that was an opportunity where I really did have an opportunity to get to know their personalities a little bit more, because at this time you're spending like a few days in the market with these people.
Yeah.
And they performed at St. Andrew's Club.
Oh, wow. That's a small club.
To this day, that was still one of the best nights of hip hop in Detroit that we still talk about.
Wow.
They killed it. And I just look back over pictures from that night and it just takes me back. So I was really happy to have been a part of the success of that album. They delivered. They wrapped their behinds off. The lyrics were amazing. The energy behind it was amazing. And I still have my plaque somewhere on a wall out there because I worked my behind off on that album. So I'm glad I got my plaque.
Thank you for your service. Thank you for helping kids like me find the Fugees, because we were all shaped by that record. Yeah. It sounded different than every other hip hop album that was coming out. You know, I listened to like a ton of rap, a ton of hip hop between 1992 and 1996. And then the score came out and we were like, this is different.
Yeah.
These three are different and everything's going to be different from now on.
They just had a different swag, a different sound, a different style, but it was refreshing. It was something
so refreshing.
It was just a refreshing body of work. So
yeah,
it was great. And that was the beginning of more to come from each of them individually.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, collectively when we would all get together in different spaces. So yeah, it was fun.
So moving on, can we talk about Destiny's Child?
Sure.
So Beyonce is one of the biggest stars of our time. So talk to me about what it was like to work with her at the beginning with the self-titled album, 1998. Talk to me about what it was like asking radio stations to play a Destiny's Child song.
Well, I will tell you, for me at the time, I was still a college rep. So my target audience were the younger age audiences, and my radio stations were college radio. And so for me, unlike commercial radio stations, college radio, they were always eager. My DJs and PDs and MDs were always eager to get fresh music and new music. And they didn't care if they were unknown artists or developing artists. They truly live by the mantra, you heard it here first. Like they didn't care If it was good music, they wanted it and they would support it and get behind it. And so for me, with my target audiences, it was a fairly easy job, only because too, they delivered. It was undeniable music. And the singles were chosen very well also. And they had a look, they had a style. The girls loved them. The guys probably fantasized about them. And
probably.
I'm sure. And so it was really dope. Now, when it comes to individual time spent, it was always spent with the team collectively. I never had, during the early years, any one-on-one, or even in the later years, I didn't have much one-on-one time with Beyonce. Sure. But, you know, again, you know, we had the original members and then they kind of transitioned after, you know, to add Michelle. And it was actually pretty cool. They were always very nice. Kelly and Beyonce, of course, always stood out to me, but they were just really nice people. There was nothing ever pretentious about them. And even to this day, from the times that I've met them or have been around, whether it was in a working position or just as a fan, nothing pretentious at all. It's generally the entourage that's the most pretentious folk, you know, that gets on your nerves and make you want to just punch them in the face. But the artists themselves, they were, you know, she was always very nice. They were always very nice.
I remember hearing No, No, No right at the beginning. It was probably like a TRL debut or something like that. And, you know, here's this, this new group, but we didn't know what was coming up the pipeline for them. You know, you never know what's going to happen next.
No, you don't. But you went with Destiny's Child, you knew it was special and you knew they were going to be around for a while.
Yeah.
Now, I did get a little nervous when they started doing the group changing dynamics and then the little rumors. And you just kind of say, oh, geez, not you. I don't want this to go in that realm. But they all came together and it worked. You know what I mean? It really worked. And again, you just kind of know that they're going to go places. I knew that I could just see that Beyonce was going to do some solo work. Cause to me, just coming up, that's just what people did. Paul McCartney did it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I could name quite a few. I didn't expect that it would go where she was straight solo, you know, but of course, you know, they come back together. Right. But yeah, they were special. I think it was a great, great signing for Columbia Records. And for after a while, for a long time, Destiny's Child really carried Columbia Records and they were always top priorities whenever they dropped, you know, and rightfully so. So yeah, it was actually pretty cool. I do have, you know, a memory of sorts there where I can remember we set them up to do, to sing the national anthem in DC for the Washington Wizards at the time.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because Solange was running around with these two pigtails on the size of her head. They were long. She had these knee socks up to her knees and every 5 minutes she was doing these cheers. And I can remember saying, oh my gosh, if you do one more cheer, I'm just going to run. But Solange was like this little 12-year-old girl, 12 or 13, I'm thinking, just every 5 minutes, go, yes, stop, go, you know, it's just like, they were like cheers, but it was like a little dance routine, you know, kind of the stuff that you do outside with your friends in front of your house.
Now everybody puts it on TikTok.
yeah. So that was fun to remember her at that age. But at the time I was going through heartbreak, this was before I quit my job. And I found out a few things and I was really, really sad. And it's just, you know, you could, I guess Miss Knowles, Tina could feel it or she could see it, but she was the only one who could. I was just working around, like making sure DJs got their pictures. Everybody knew what was what, whatever, whatever, before the girls went down to sing. And Tina stopped me and she said, hey, you're okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm good. And she's like, mm-mm. Come sit right here. And I sat down and she, and I told her, I said, yeah, I'm just kind of going through a little heartbreak right now. And she gave me the best auntie pep talk from the heart. Now, mind you, all this other stuff is going on and I really should be working the room, right? Making sure everybody's good, which, you know, we had the rest of the team, so they were good, but she actually gave me some of the best advice. And little did I know, she was really speaking from experience, which would later come out in tabloids. But it was just something that always touched me and I never forgot. And she was just such a sweetheart, and her advice really did help me get through. It helped me to grow some wings for a little while.
Share a little bit about what it was.
Well, again, at the time I was dealing with heartbreak in my relationship, and you know, her thing to me was, you know, you're not the first, you're definitely not going to be the last. And, you know, you cannot allow people and sadness and things like that. You know, it's just general advice, but sometimes you just need to hear it. But one thing that she made me promise was that I was going to put myself first, and I was going to put that heartbreak and that sadness in the place that it deserved to be and not allow it to handicap me or hinder me. And then she was like, I need you to just look in the mirror. You know, go look at yourself, look at who you are, stand in who you are royalty, and you better walk in that. Mm-hmm. And it was what I needed to hear. And, you know, she was just like, you know, we all go through it, young and old, we go through it, but are you going to allow it to hinder you or handicap you? Don't stay in this space. You shake your feet, you know, shake the dust off your feet and you keep going. And I needed that. You know, she said a few other things too, not to belabor the interview, but it was amazing. And to this day, I just really appreciate that she was Tina Knowles. Yeah. And Tina Knowles was able to step outside of manager of my artist and my daughter and my girls to let me tap into this representative here, because I'm feeling a little something. I'm gonna talk to her girl to girl, and I'm gonna see what's happening with her, because I care that much to pull her aside to sit her on this sofa in this suite and talk to her. And as she talked to me, she grabbed my hand and she was just kind of like rubbing my hand when she was talking to me, and I appreciated that. I never forgot that moment.
I love that. I absolutely love that. I love knowing that type of person can exist in the world and be so closely connected to music that's getting created, raising children who are making music that, you know, I think a lot of people listening to this have had their hands held by Beyonce's music, Destiny's Child music, you know, that's something that music does, is it holds your hand, you know, and wherever Beyonce came from, that empathy that Tina showed to you is part of her DNA, part of her system, you know.
But when you listen to the Solange Seat at the Table, which is still my favorite album that she's put out, it's apparent.
Yeah.
Even in her songs, in her songwriting, they raised some amazing girls and they are superstars in their own right. You know what I mean? For what I see them as, or refer to a superstar as, right? Yeah. But those were definitely some of the moments where it's not this unreachable, pretentious industry kind of thing.
Ego-driven.
Exactly. It's just human to human. You know, music brought us together, but, you know, we were able to connect on a different level. And I appreciated that night.
Throughout this podcast, as I'm talking to people, one thing keeps coming up over and over again, and that's relationships, relationship building.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You know, it's a relationship industry. Music is a relationship medium. Mm-hmm. And it sounds, you know, hearing you talk about the college DJs and the college markets that were like eager to hear from you, you know, you had to have good relationships with those people. They had to trust your taste. They had to know that you were going to follow through on the things you were promising to do. Directed toward the students, let's just talk a little bit about relationship building in the music business and what that kind of means with regard to like vulnerability and empathy and some things that have come up along the way.
Yeah. Well, I will say I wouldn't be where I am right now if it weren't for relationships. I wouldn't have gotten where my start if it wasn't for relationships. I can't emphasize that enough. Like developing pure, real, on the money relationships and not burning your bridges. Like, you burn a bridge here in our industry, but I think in any industry, because you'll realize the world is very small. When I really sit back and I think about it, I am truly one, at most 2 degrees of separation from anybody.
Yeah.
When I really think about it, and word gets around, but bad words gets around faster. And we know how people love to spread those things. And so you got to be careful. There are a lot of wolves out here, unfortunately, in our game, but I think it's true of a lot of industries. And there are people that are very kind and vulnerable too. You got to be careful if you're kind of vulnerable, because you will get run over. I allowed myself to get used a lot of times because I always saw the good in people. And when my intuition would go off and tell me certain things, I believed the sweet words over what my intuition would tell me. And I would end up getting burned or used, you know, really, really badly. But at the end of the day, yes, I can't stress that enough. Developing good relations. And then when you're doing that, think about what you can bring to the table and not always what you're going to extract from somebody. Mm-hmm. People will see through that a mile away, and they don't want to deal with you if the only thing you're coming for is to ask. Well, how are you going to invest in this relationship, and what value do you bring to a relationship as well? And I think honesty is key. But again, you know, I'm just not going to sugarcoat it. There are a lot of wolves in sheep's clothing out here. There are a lot of people that will sell their soul to the devil to grow up this ladder. And there are a lot of people who will send their mama right up the pike to get a stab at the chart. It's just what it is. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. I have seen it. I still see it. It's going to be like that till Jesus comes back. So you just got to be ready for it. And you have to, you know, just pay attention, learn about the people in your market, learn about the people in your backyard, as well as internationally, you know, who's out here doing what you want to do, who's out here making moves that you'd like to make, who's out here inspiring you. There's one thing that I learned in developing relationship. There's nothing more that people love, except for me. You probably wouldn't get that from this interview, but there's nothing more that people love than talking about themselves.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, setting up informational interviews, inviting people out for coffee, you know, when COVID is over, that kind of stuff can take you a long way. A 5-minute informational interview will more than likely end up morphing into a 20-minute or a half an hour.
Yeah.
But it's so super important. And again, that's exactly how I got to where I am. And that's how I am able to maintain some level of status in life besides God, because of course, nobody trumps him, you know, bottom line. Nobody trumps. I don't care who you are. You're not about to step up in that piece. But but anyway, yeah. Like whatever path he put before me, I don't care who it is. You're not going to stop it. But yeah, just going back. Pay attention, nurture them, don't use them, don't abuse them, and don't take any wooden nickels, please.
Perfect. You said something in there that I want to come back to, knowing your value and knowing what you bring to the table. I want to talk about charging what you're worth for a second. And, you know, you had mentioned an internship at PolyGram. I remember those days. Was that an unpaid internship?
It was an unpaid internship, but I did get college credit. Okay. So that was my benefit.
Yeah.
You know, that was my currency. The other currency that I had was hands-on experience in an industry that very few people could get into or learn or know how to get beyond the gatekeepers kind of thing. And so the experiences, the things that I learned, the relationships that I was able to gain from it, that was worth more than gold.
Yeah.
You know, that was worth more than any amount of money. Now, the key with that is that my internship was well structured, and they didn't have us come in there thinking, what can I get from you? Free labor. They put together a program so they knew that when I walked away, I was going to know some stuff. I was going to learn. And I hate when people even to this day, when I talk to people and they're like, oh, I need help. I'm just going to get me an intern. No, bro. It's more than just getting free help. What are you going to invest in this person? How are you going to set yourself up so that you deserve their talent, their work? You know, what are they going to walk away with? And so I would say for people that are out there looking for opportunities, you really have to know what, you know, how you're going to be taught. What are you going to learn? And hold them accountable. Don't give away your talent for free just to say, I did it.
Yeah.
You know, what are you doing this for? But yeah, so the internship was invaluable.
So if somebody's, you know, transitioning from an unpaid internship and then moving into the workforce, how can they put a dollar value on their work when they know that there are interns who are willing to do that for free? Well, you know, like, how can we kind of like guide students toward being comfortable asking for money? Because what I know from the last 6 months of when I was doing this internship is super valuable. And now I want to give it to you. And I want to have a relationship with you, but you have to pay me. And don't just go hire some college student who will do it for free.
You know what? There's no way to get around it. You have to know your value. You have to know your worth. And if someone is saying, I don't want to pay you, okay, let's think about this thing. Like, for instance, I, to this day, as I am in my remix mode, am looking and digging deeper into licensing and publishing and sync.
Sure.
So if I had an opportunity as a grown professional woman that makes decent money, if I had the opportunity to go work with Steven Spielberg's organization, to be able to be exposed to or work in with music supervisors or whatever, and they said, but you know what? We just can't pay you, but this is what we can offer. And I know that it's going to allow me to level up. That's worth me doing. I'm just going to get a part-time job, or I'm going to do some side work, contract work, but I'm going for that opportunity because I see where in the long run, hopefully not a long run, but you know what I mean? How I can take that and level up, but I'm going to keep in mind what I'm there for, what I'm trying to glean from it, learn from it. And I'm going to give myself a cutoff date.
Sure. Yeah. That's important.
You know, there are people that they don't care. You can't make anybody pay you. You can only stand by, you know, what your value and your worth is and what you need and what you need to get out of. And if they're not willing to do that and they're willing to just try to go, but look, at the end of the day, you're trying to get this free labor, but you're probably not going to get the results that you want. Right. And so sometimes people have to burn themselves like that, trying to be cheap, you know, before they realize I need to pay a little something, something. And they may circle back, but at the end of the day, you can't win them all. You just got to keep going.
Yeah. When you were, you know, college repping, did you have sales goals? Did you have reports?
We established sales goals based upon the market and things like that. Now, at the time, you know, our sales reps and things like that within the system, there's so many moving parts to this music business. And there's a lot of inner workings on the back end that some people don't really realize are there. But in the day of streaming and digital and stuff, a lot of those middlemen have been cut out anyway. But the larger sales team were really the ones when I was a college rep that established the goals. And then I helped to supplement that with the work that I was doing to drive people in. Once I grew up that ladder, yes, I had goals for getting the middlemen, which were the one stops, to order in a certain amount of products. I had a number of goals for retailers to bring in and help hopefully sell a certain amount of product. We set up different campaigns and different sales programs and different things like that to offer discounts so that they can lower their prices for them to be able to sell a certain amount of product. So there was a lot of strategy that went into the world of sales and marketing in order for us to meet the goals, which were set out quarterly and then annually. So yeah, we definitely had those.
And that's something that independent artists have to kind of think about when they're releasing music, right?
You want to think about that. You want to have a goal in mind, because if you don't know what you're striving for, then you're just haphazardly doing stuff, right?
Yeah.
You want to have your milestones that you want to reach. And if things aren't working, you need to stay in tune with those things so that you can stop and pivot left or pivot right if they're not working. It's a little different these days too, because of the realm of digital. Everybody and their mom's an artist. Every 5 minutes, 10,000 songs are being unleashed into the marketplace. So on and so forth.
Accurate statistic.
Yeah. And you're vying for the attention of, you know, of people. And quite honestly, you only get so many seconds to grab their attention. And you want them to keep coming back and you want them to become loyal to you. So there's all kinds of strategies that you have to think about to generate that. And then of course, you know, publishing.
Let's talk about publishing for a minute.
Yeah, publishing is so super important, because single and album sales and song sales are one thing, but you get most of your money through publishing. There's, you know, as a friend of mine and I were talking about earlier, there's more millionaires out here who've made their money off publishing than successful artists who made their money off of song sales.
Tell me more about that.
Well, with publishing, for instance, and your royalties and things like that, you're able to earn money through performances, through, you know, your streaming, through, you know, all those different things. And that can go on, that can last, that can, you know, people engaging with your music. You have more opportunities for placements and things like that, where you can earn your publishing. People aren't buying music anymore. Right. And the algorithms are so crazy to this day. To me, I don't know how streaming, you know, the behind the scenes work of what accounts for a stream on this platform and a stream and how many streams equate to a dollar. And, you know, it's a big old game that you really have to put your hat to the back and just really pay attention to. But music isn't selling like it used to, but you can generate and you can really stand strong on your publishing. That's like, your publishing is key. You know, it's one thing to try to get points on a song and, you know, all this kind of thing to get your mechanicals and things like that in for your song sales. But at the end of the day, you're going to make way more money, I think, on, you know, on the publishing. People wanting to license your song, cover your song, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Remix it. Yeah.
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 Have more opportunity there.
I was looking up the statistics on I Want to Dance with Somebody by Whitney Houston, which was written by Shannon Rubicam and George Merrill from the band Boy Meets Girl.
Okay.
They also wrote Waiting for a Star to Fall. I love that song. So I looked her songwriting credits up, Shannon Rubicam. She has 310 songwriting credits, and hundreds of them are remixes of I Want to Dance with Somebody.
And she can still eat.
I mean, I think she probably wrote 15, 20, maybe 30 songs total. And all the rest of them are remixes of I Want to Dance with Somebody or remixes of How Will I Know.
Yep.
And what that makes me want to encourage people to do is refine their songwriting strategy. Get linked up with a good producer. Find a good songwriting team. Write good songs. Create good intellectual property, because a good song is going to last 50, 70, 100 years. A good recording is good for a handful of time before technology changes, before the vocals sound outdated, you know. But a well-written song is sheet music or tabs. It's lyrics online. It's behind an important scene in a movie. It's covers.
Mm-hmm. But you know what? Those are things that some people don't realize. There was something that I think we talked about at one time. What did you wish you knew before?
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah. What did you wish you knew?
And so for me, number one, that you could get paid for having fun and doing what you love and never work a day in your life.
You get paid to hang out with the Fugees.
Oh, but you know what? It was even more than that. It's just like you get paid to, like, my homework was getting up and looking at the charts and listening to songs and, you know, figuring out how, what angle I was going to use to blow this up, you know, watching videos and studying them, you know, like, come on, would you stop it? What? I get to do this and set up tours and everything else. Even though we worked hard, we played hard, we worked harder, sometimes many sleepless nights. But anyway, going from there, outside of knowing that as a younger person, that the things that I was doing and being tapped on and me doing it freely because I loved it, that there were more professional people that were making thousands doing what I did. You know what I mean? This was like, okay. But the second thing was really understanding how publishing works. And I'm still learning, you know, it's an ongoing thing for me. But it wasn't until the days that I worked with Prince or worked at, you know, with the Paisley Park system, and then understanding even before then how he was pushing artists to own their masters with the whole, remember the slave on his face.
Let's talk about that. Were you around for that time?
For that time, I was not.
Okay.
But during the time that I was around, he and I had a few conversations where he asked, like, because he was really concerned that radio really wasn't backing him. Now, mind you, this was all also during the time right in between Raven to the Joy Fantastic and, you know, when he kind of went off into indie land, but his songs were more avant-garde as well. So they weren't mainstream. So it was difficult for radio, you know, mainstream radio to really play his songs to fit in this, you know, this whatever. And so he actually asked, we were all standing around in a circle and he looked at me, he's like, well, why is this? And, you know, I share with him my thoughts or whatever. And I didn't want to say, but, you know, right now you're not putting out Purple Rain. You're putting out some really avant-garde songs, you know, that that are very, very complex, you know, or what have you. So during those times, though, as he was trying to understand how to really work this thing from an independent standpoint, how to break through some of these glass ceilings that he was hitting, but then pushing and trying to get people to understand the importance of owning your masters, the importance of getting your credits, the importance of publishing. That's what triggered in me to get out from behind the sales and marketing realm to more onto that side to understand it all. I had an opportunity to meet, his name is Kashif. He was an amazing music business person, artist, songwriter. And he passed away, but he wrote a book, Everything You Better Know About the Music Industry. Mm-hmm. And to this day, that's like an industry Bible to me. And that is where I also learned more about the importance of understanding publishing. So I say all this to say, before I started, I worked with quite a few independent artists. I didn't really understand publishing. When we would do their performances and things like that, had I known to really say, hey, go register this song that you just performed, because this venue was actually reports to ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, you can get performance royalties from this. You can earn money from this. I didn't know about a lot of that. So for a lot of these artists and things like that, and songwriters, a lot of their money that they could have been collecting went to the black box and spread out amongst other songwriters that are represented by that performance rights organization. So to this day, again, those are still like valuable lessons. And I meet a lot of people, several that are established that are still not registering their music with Sound Exchange, you know, and things like that. They're just having fun. And it's just like, but you need to be making money.
Yeah. I just talked to somebody about that yesterday. It'll come out after yours, but he was saying you can use CD Baby and you don't have to opt into the publishing. You can just distribute your music. And he said so many people don't publish their music. And then they're like, how come I can't get any sync licenses? It's like, well, you're not published. Mm-hmm. And we cannot legally sync a song that's not published.
Right.
Period. Mm-hmm. End of, you know, refer to copyright law. End of story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so complicated that most people are like, oh, that's too complicated. I'm just not going to worry about it. I'm just going to make music and put it up on Bandcamp and it'll be fine. And that's not the business. That's a hobby, which is great. We need hobby musicians. Mm-hmm. But if you're writing songs that are so good that you can do this professionally, and then you're not publishing them, it's like writing a book and putting it in your closet and, you know, letting your next door neighbor read it. Like, it has to be published. It has to be distributed through the proper channels, or you're missing out on more than half of the business opportunities.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And, you know, just something else to throw out there right now, it's like touring and merch. Besides, like that's where the money is. Gotta have some dope merch.
Yeah.
Gotta get these shows in. You know, the game has changed, you know.
Yeah.
It changed a long time ago. This isn't fresh. This isn't new, but you still have to remind people because they think that they can just put something up and get it on Spotify and sit there and wait, you know. And right now, the places where people are discovering music more than anything these days are through playlists, you know, and things like that. So, you know, and I think just as a sidebar, I think we all, no matter what year of being in the game we are, how fresh or how new or how established we are, we should always stay hungry to want to know more, learn more, and always be in a state of discovery. A place of discovery. There's too many people that are still stuck in the old way of doing things or think they know it all.
Yeah.
And now you've got companies like Songvest and different ones who, you know, are doing deals with artists and selling shares of songs. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just like, you will get left behind, sister, brother. You know, you better stay up on it if this is the game you want to be in. We're in the Jetson age of the music business now. This 21st century game is a whole lot different. And then keeping up and abreast, you know, of what's happening in Congress and, you know, all that kind of thing. So it's very vast. I know we've kind of gone in different lanes right now, but these are just all things before I leave. I just want to be able to say, and me for myself, you know, it's a little difficult sometimes because there's so much coming at you where, you know, you're just trying to keep up with everything, you know, but it's still fun research.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's all fun.
Yeah.
One other thing that I think I would just love to drive home, especially for the person who may live in Iowa and Utah or, you know, Oklahoma, somewhere off the beaten path of the New York, Atlanta, LA scope. Detroit is what it is, right? We do have an amazing group of artists and small industry here. We all know one another. We're all friends. It's the funniest thing, but it's still not a big industry. We don't have a large at all music industry here. And it was this that's happening now is still kind of reflective of what it was when I was coming up. And people used to always make me feel like I was not going to be able to land a great role in it or work in it because I wasn't in one of the bigger cities. And I just want to let people know, like, at the end of the day, if you want it, you can achieve it. You can do it. You know, don't allow what you're seeing around you and those boundaries to hinder you. Of course, I do have to go out at times into these markets to rub elbows and do things like that. But at the same time, I was able to grow and build a very strong career path starting here in Detroit. And I am back here in Detroit. Yeah, it's not Atlanta, you know what I mean? But I can still do business in Atlanta and I'm still able to do business here. So don't let your geographical location dictate to you your success or failure in this business, if this is what you want. I guess that's what I'm trying to say in a nutshell.
I love it. Yeah, I relate to that. Living here in Detroit, I grew up in Cleveland and then I moved to Chicago and I felt like a really small fish in a really big pond. And, you know, Chicago, everybody tours through Chicago. So there was tons of work, tons of bands, tons of venues. I never had a shortage of work and people knew me, you know, I have a great network, great relationships, but to succeed in a city that size, you have to come in with money, capital, assets. You have to have something to give that I just didn't have at the time. Mm-hmm. And when I moved here for family, I felt like my knowledge was my asset. And I didn't need that kind of capital. I didn't need to start a business that employed other people like I would have in Chicago. And I was able to just sit down at my desk and do people's tax returns. And that was the value that I was able to bring. You know, people live here, people record here, and then they travel to LA. They all need to file a tax return.
So. Exactly. I mean, and understanding if you're an artist or a writer, we know where the big markets are. But the good thing is that and we learned this with the pandemic, people weren't getting together in studios and things. They were writing from the comforts of home and allowing technology to do the file exchange, recording, sending it back, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
If you don't know how to use technology to exploit it, to get where you need to be, take a lesson, go to YouTube University, talk to people that are doing it, because you can rock out in this business from anywhere.
I love it. That's fantastic advice. Okay, so two more things, and then I have to let you go.
Sure.
Number one, will you come back with Danon as a trio? Do you think that's something we could do?
There's always possibility.
All right, I'm going to plant that seed right now.
I'll definitely ask. Okay. You know, we're preparing. Thankfully, I'm just so super excited for he and the team and the other artists. They're going to be rocking out for Super Bowl.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, no rush on that, you know, like next year sometime.
Yeah,
it would be really cool to talk to him about his remixes, working with Robert Glasper. I want to hear how you guys work together as business partners, that kind of thing.
Well, his history is so vast. I mean, this guy had an opportunity to work with Sting. You know what I mean? His discography is amazing and the music that he creates is amazing. And I think he's a musical genius. And the good thing about him is that he pushes me to stay on my toes for real. And he's always light years ahead of the game. I will just say that. He's always light years ahead. He's ahead of his time. Doesn't get the respect to me that he deserves, but that's not what he does it for. He's a humble giant in this game. And I think that's another reason why I love, you know, working with him and having the opportunity to work with him, because he's definitely an underdog, but, you know, he's a force to be reckoned with. He knows it, you know what I mean? And the industry knows it, but, you know, it's just a certain kind of way that we slay this cat. You get what I'm saying? So I will definitely ask.
All right, cool.
If he would be interested in coming on, I'm sure he would.
That would be great. And I want to let you know, you are a humble giant too.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. Look, it's the most difficult thing for me to talk about myself, but this more of why I came was just to try to impart the things that I've learned. I'm still learning. I think the music industry, music in and of itself is a gift from God, bottom line. And I'm just so happy that I was able to be in it and I'm still able to be in it. There's a lot of remixing and a lot of reinvention that goes along with this thing to stay in it, to stay active, to stay relevant. You got to keep that FaceTime out there because out of sight is out of mind a lot of times.
Yeah.
But for me, I work more behind the scenes. I'm not the one running up to DJs now. Hey, DJ, play my record. Now, that's not me anymore. I'm more interested in focusing on the behind the scenes, publishing, licensing, sync. You know, at one time I had the opportunity to work for Bronner Brothers as a contractor. Well, they were a client, I should say. And I had an opportunity, you know, to do product placement and music videos. And that opened me up to a whole other thing of how, you know, money can be made. Yeah. And, you know, in different ways. And so when it comes to music, though, the sky's the limit and things are just constantly being there. People are so innovative. So you got to keep your fingers on the pulse.
Yeah. Yep. The last thing I want to talk to you about is I thought it was really cool how you were just telling a story about Prince and he looked at you and said, "What do you think?" And I love the idea that Prince, years and years into his career, was not motivated by his ego, didn't assume he knew everything. He was asking for opinions. He was asking for help. And is that something that he did a lot?
Well, I wasn't around him a lot. Let's just say that.
Even just working with his team.
Yeah. I got a chance to talk to him a few times. And during the times that we did talk, it was, you know, in the midst of discussions about strategy or, you know, just a spur of the moment, you know, that kind of thing. He knew a lot. This man knew a lot. That was apparent in even the interviews and the things that he had. He knew a lot. He learned a lot. He was always open to know more. And when he asked the opinion, it was, you know, just kind of like, okay, I know what I'm seeing, but what are you seeing? And why is it from your standpoint, since this is your specialty, are things this way? You know, he had already had a knowledge base and a, you know, understanding, but to want to hear it from other people who live in this world every day.
Yeah.
Because he was coming from a business owner and an artist and a creative and an owner of his creative, you know, currency and talent, I should say, to those of us who are on the opposite side, either pushing that talent or having the conversations with the gatekeepers, you know. And so that was kind of how a lot of that came about. Now, when he asked my opinion about what I thought after having the opportunity to sit in a venue while he rehearsed the band, it was just me by myself with a bartender at the bar preparing to open the club. That when he turned around after they blazed the stage in rehearsal and asked me, was that all right? Dude, come on. Could I not step out and run around? Like, I forget about those experiences. I just have to share that because that, I think, when I die, I need that to go on my gravestone. She actually had an opportunity to watch Frisbee Hearst's band sitting on a stool 10 feet from the stage by herself.
I wish I could dig through your memories.
I've got some, I promise you. I really do have some. And the more and more I have these discussions, they just start to be unearthed. So I really am excited, and I'm happy for the things that God has allowed me to experience, to be able to end up in the industry that I claim so deeply and wanted so deeply from the age 7 and 8, and to still, so many years later, be able to have a foot in it on my terms, you know, and be able to shape it right now. The lanes are wide open. Like, there's less blocks for people, but you have to understand, once you enter the ring, you're out here with millions of people. And so whether you stay to fight another day or you just say, you know what, I'm good, is going to depend on your knowledge, your relationships, your get up and go. You got to wake and bake every day. You can't sleep. If this is what you want to do, you got to do it. And, you know, be open and be humble enough to learn.
Yeah, I love that. As we wrap up, I hope you'll come back, even if it's just you. I would love to do part two. And is there anything that you want to leave us with?
Well, for me, thank you, number one, for having me. I'm just super excited for everybody who's listening, who decided to try this thing out that we call music and music business. I just know, for me, probably from when I was in the womb, I knew that this is what I wanted to do and wanted to be in. Music is a gift from God. Some of you may or may not believe in him, but it is a gift from God. And it's apparent in how, even with everything that's going on in the world today, we can all come together through music. That's the one unifying thing that is out here right now that brings, that crosses all boundaries, that brings everybody together. When I think of John Lennon's Imagine, when I think of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, and I think about the power of song and the power of lyric in sending a message, in bringing people together. When I think about freaking Kool and the Gang, Celebrate, how even many years later, that's still a song that uplifts you, or Lovely Day, you know, and how that makes you feel. Music is something to be felt, and it launches movements. And so with that being said, respect it, celebrate it, and bring others into it. And I just wish everybody the best. And, you know, hey, we'll see. I'll see you out there as we, you know, run rampant in this thing we call the music business. But yeah, I just leave with that. It's a blessing and treat it as such.
I love it. You're amazing. Thank you so much for coming.
Of course. I will talk with you.
When Songs Mean Business is a production of Steph Belcher Business Management, LLC. Huge thank you to Sabrina Underwood for joining me today. And as always, thanks to The Dropout or The Break Music. This episode was recorded, edited, and produced by me, Steph Belcher. And if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to join our Facebook group, When Songs Mean Business. And please follow me on Instagram, @When Songs Mean Business. Thank you so much for listening and have a wonderful day.